Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me today. Since publishing his debut novel, Green on Blue, in 2015, veteran and National Book Award finalist Elliot Ackerman has continued writing at a prolific rate, with three books out in just the last 3 years alone. He joins us now with his newest, this time a memoir. It's titled Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. Elliot, welcome back to All of It.
No, thanks so much for having me.
So in this book, it's interesting. It seems like you had questions you wanted answered, and you went out to find them. What were the questions that you wanted answered, and how long have you had these questions?
This is a book that I was writing, and I didn't actually know I was writing it, because I also do a lot of work as a journalist. Mm-hmm. And so often when I'm like researching a novel, or I'm, you know, immersing myself in something that will become a novel, you know, I found myself doing bits of journalism along the way. Like, they're kind of like my trail of breadcrumbs.
Sure.
And at a certain point, I think I kind of had a critical mass. And it was actually my girlfriend looked at me at one point, and she was like, you know, you're writing a book. And I was like, I don't think I'm writing a book. She's like, look at this. You're clearly, there's something going on, and all of these bits of journalism you've been doing are linked together, and there's a book here. So she encouraged me to start looking at it in that light. And, you know, I did see there was a book there. And I think the questions are many. And if this book like has a shape, I don't think the shape of the book is a linear one where there's like a beginning, a middle, or an end. I actually think it's sort of circular, in that the journey you're taking is kind of, you know, you're going to each of many different points along the circumference of this circle, but what each of these points have in common, just like a circle has a common, is there's a common center point. And the center point are wartime experiences that I had, and the journey of the book is kind of doing a loop around those experiences, so you can look at them from every angle, whether that's in Syria or in Turkey where I used to live, or going back to old battlefields in Iraq.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The book, it's sort of like a three-dimensional game of chess. There's all these different elements to it, but you know it's all working towards one sort of, not a final goal, but one sort of final picture. I am curious, but before we talk about details in the book, you know, in the book you write about some of the most difficult situations you found yourself in, some of the most difficult situations you saw other people in, people being wounded, people losing their lives. What made you want to go back to that time and also physically go to places that could put you in danger again?
I think in terms of like remembering, it's not like I'm going back to those times. You know, like they're always with me. Like they those experiences have informed who I am. Like people will sometimes ask me, how did the war change you? And I've never known how to answer that question, because I'm like, you know, the war, it made me. I mean,
because you're you.
I'm you. And I grew up in the war.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to answer that question. So it was more just an exploration of like, well, what did all these experiences mean? You know, when you start to sit down and really reflect on them, and why did people do the things that they did? And, you know, the book is really a reflection on that.
Were you ever, physically being back in some of those places, what did that feel like?
Well, the thing that's funny is people will often, because I covered the war in Syria, and people will often say, well, you know, as a Marine, that must have been very dangerous or frightening. And I would say, you know, it's in some respects, being a journalist is more frightening. You know, when you're a Marine, it's sort of like you're with, you know, you're in a really bad neighborhood, but you're with like one of the toughest, baddest gangs in the neighborhood.
Oh, that's
interesting.
And
you've got
everyone
with you. You know, when you're a journalist, you're like,
you have a jacket that says press.
Or you're like the hapless guy and his like Mercedes who drove into the bad neighborhood, who's like, excuse me, sir, could you give me directions?
Yeah.
You know, so so it's a very different feeling being there as a participant versus being there as someone who is observing as a journalist.
And you start with Syria, and you write in your foreword that you came to Syria to take a look at another war. What kind of insights do you think that you have, you know, as a Marine and a journalist, into Syria that a normal everyday civilian, even a well-informed one, might not know?
Yeah. You know, this book began from, I mentioned my girlfriend's the one who told me to write it. She actually told me to write it. We found ourselves in London for a weekend, and we were at a museum, and there was the National Portrait Gallery there, and there was a portrait of Edmund Burke, who was this like 18th century British writer. And he wrote, very famous, wrote a book called Reflections on the Revolution in France. And if you read that book, he wrote it in 1790, so 10 years after our revolution, he's not really writing about France and what just happened there as much as he's writing about the failed British experience and, you know, what was in the American colonies. And so it was this idea, when you are writing about one subject, but another subject keeps looking back at you, that is a reflection. And so I found myself, every time I was writing about what was going on in Syria, what kept coming back to me were these experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so the book kind of has that impressionistic reflective tone, and that I'm always sort of writing about both topics, and they operate, those events operate in tandem with each other.
You've spent a lot of time, you offer us history that some people may not know, or that has been manipulated over time, about this area, about Iraq and Afghanistan. And what is something that you think fundamentally about the way the United States approached war in the 21st century that was misguided?
I think we only have half an hour, you know. But you know, all war is misguided, right? Because fundamental to war is always a miscalculation. Because when people go to war, both sides calculate that they are going to win, and somebody is always wrong. So hardwired into all war is this type of miscalculation and this bungling. But, you know, with respect to, you know, some of the history that's in the book, is, you know, when you look at war and people ascribe to war, you know, many words, you know, glory, honor, freedom, you know, these very, very big war words that are present, particularly in the rhetoric in the run-up to a war. When you get to the back end of the war, none of those words are really there anymore. And the only thing that you're left with, as the title of the book infers, is sort of like these places, names, some dates. And the historical portions of the book show how, you know, the places and the names of places and people are still very much present in that part of the world, from, you know, from T.E. Lawrence of Arabia 100 plus years ago up to today. I mean, there is a complete and total straight line. And if you were there, you see it, and you see how people live with it, to say nothing of the American experience in Iraq the last 10 years. I mean, we declared the war over in 2011. I mean, it's not over.
Right. My guest is Elliot Ackerman. The name of his book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. There's very little, if I'm thinking, actually, there's not politics in this book at all. And I'm curious, if you're someone who has fought in a war, do you come back political at all? Does it have an impact on the way you view politics and the way you view the politicians who make the decisions about where to send people?
Well, the war wasn't about politics for me, if I'm being honest. I mean, the reason I wound up in the Marine Corps, and the reason I wound up staying 8 years and redeploying in and out of war zones, had very little to actually do with politics. It had to do with, you know, when I was 17, 18 years old, kind of having this desire to serve, this interest in the military. Then once I got into the military, it had a lot to do with the people, the friend, you know, who I do write about, who are my friends, and the feeling of obligations we had to one another. So those were the reasons I was there. So I think to, you know, start writing about these more abstract political ideas, they, you know, I don't want to speak for all veterans, but I think most of the folks I served with, that's not what we were necessarily talking about. We were talking about the much more immediate concerns of whatever our specific mission was, and how we were trying to take care of one another.
There's a really interesting line in your book. You said, in this part of the world, extremism is not a fait accompli. It has been brought about by a certain set of conditions: lawlessness, sectarian violence, and corruption. These create fertile ground for radical ideologies to take root. Why was it important to make that point?
I think you start to see patterns emerge in conflict where you see, and I think you know, this does get a little political, is you see the U.S., and we've done this all over the globe, where we invest ourselves in a conflict, then we pull out and we leave a power vacuum, and then we're suddenly very surprised when all sorts of nasty things flood into that vacuum. And so, you know, we saw that in Afghanistan in the 1990s. We saw it after we withdrew in 2011 in Iraq, when the Islamic State came about. Mm-hmm. And we keep making this similar set of mistakes. And I just thought I'd point it out.
In the book, you want to talk to different kinds of people. And one of the people you want to talk to is someone who fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And you have a fixer who helps you with this arrangement. What did you want to get out of that experience?
Well, the fixer who helped me that, you know, was a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And he was a Syrian from Damascus and had been very active in the peaceful democratic protests early on in the Arab Spring, and had wound up living as a refugee in southern mm-hmm. Turkey. And so he was actually working for an NGO that a couple of friends of mine were working for, and we were all living in a house. One day, about 9 at night, he came and he drove in. He'd been out in the field all day, and he said to me, "He's like, well, you know, Elliot, I met a guy today in a Çakılay refugee camp, which is this very small camp on the border. He said, who I think you should meet." So I said, "Okay, Abed," it's my friend. Mm-hmm. I said, "You know, who's the guy?"
I should have said more like conduit than fixer. Yeah, sorry, I used the use a journal term.
And I said, "Oh, you know, who's the guy?" And he's like, "Well, he fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but I think you guys would really get along." And so, I think Abed knew, as I did, that, you know, there was this sort of interest. And so, you know, as much as these wars, I say, made me. Mm-hmm. When you're in the war, you have this feeling of being almost like you're engaged in a dance, and you have a dance partner, but it's kind of a shadow dance. You know, you can feel that person next to you. You can feel those forces that are your adversary, but you never see them. And so I had, you know, decades later, I was always, you know, I was curious. There's a curiosity. Who is this person who I was doing this dance with? And I know that dance defined me. And so the guy's name was Abu Hassar, and he had fought for Al-Qaeda. And so I went down to meet him kind of with a bet. And my bet is that the curiosity I had about him would be reciprocated. He would have the same curiosity about me because he had been engaged in a similar dance, and that dance had been just as defining for him as mine had been. And that proved to be the case, and we sat down and, you know, and became friends across a experiential and ideological divide.
You're right. For a moment, we sit three veterans from three different sides of a war that has no end in sight, not the Syrian civil war or the Iraq war, but a larger regional conflict. Amidst all of this, Abu Hassar has hit on a unifying thread between us, friendship born out of conflict, the strongest we've ever known. I think that's why I sought out Abu Hassar, to see if the thread binds two people who fought against each other. I just found that so interesting that you didn't, did you ever have a sense of animosity from him? Did you ever feel it coming up in yourself at all?
No, not at all. And I don't want to speak for him, but I think, you know, we met in the book, there's a series of meetings mm-hmm. over years, me and Abu Hassar. And I think we both recognized that we had a lot in common with each other. And I'll say, you know, I had more in common with Abu Hassar than I did with some people I grew up with, who didn't have that similar experience. And I think on the back end of the wars, we kind of had, both of us had a need to connect and to try to fully understand what we had gone through. And the logical conclusion of that was to reach out and sit down with one another and start asking each other questions.
But you did know that you suggest not telling him you fought initially. You suggest like introducing right. yourself as a journalist. So somewhere
Which
in your,
is what we did.
Yeah, so somewhere on. In your mind, you know that this could go sour.
Oh yes, you know you're dealing with something that could be right? combustible when you're driving down, just me and Abed, basically to the Syrian border to meet with a member of Al-Qaeda. You know, and this is the time where journalists like, you know, Foley and Soloff have gone mm-hmm. missing yeah. and mm-hmm. horrible things have happened to them. So there was, you know, there was always that. And, you know, and even as Abu Hassar and I were talking, we kind of were going in and out of, you know, he still very much adheres to a very radical view of Islam. And so, you know, our conversation sort of veers in and out of his beliefs. So at one moment, we're kind of talking about these very tactile concepts of what it meant to fight in Iraq. And the next moment, he's reminding me of the end of days battle that will occur in Dabiq and lecturing me on what the end of days battle is going to be like. And I'm sort of having
You're
to
like,
politely
and then
not.
What? You're like,
and then
what?
And then what happens?
Right.
Yeah.
My guest is Elliot Ackerman. The name of the book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. We'll continue our conversation with Elliot after a quick break.
WNYC is supported by HSS, ranked number one hospital in the country for orthopedics for 9 straight years, according to the 2019 U.S. News & World Report, in Manhattan and in Nassau, Westchester, Bergen, and Fairfield counties. More at hss.edu. The Human Rights Watch Film Festival, 13 films plus discussions on today's human rights challenges, co-presented by the Film Society of Lincoln Center and the IFC Center, June 13th to 20th. Tickets at ff.hrw.org. WNYC is a media partner of the 2019 Capital One City Parks Foundation Summer Stage, presenting Big Frida with Mike Q on June 13th, plus nearly 100 shows in all 5 boroughs through October. Summerstage.org.
Indigenous women and girls are going missing and their stories are being erased.
She just disappeared one day and they don't know what's happened to her. And that happens every day. This is normal for us.
A conversation about the crisis and new efforts to better track these crimes and end the violence. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway, weekday afternoons at 3 on 93.9 FM.
This is WNYC, 93.9 FM and AM 820, NPR News and the New York Conversation.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and my guest is Elliot Ackerman. The name of his new book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. November 10th, 2004 was your birthday, right?
It's Marine Corps' birthday.
Marine Corps'
yes.
birthday, I should say.
My birthday, too.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 24 years old.
And will you share with our listeners where you were?
That was the day my infantry battalion began the assault of Fallujah in the Second Fallujah Battle.
And that is in the history of battles in the United States. Can you give it some
context
for people?
It was the biggest urban battle since Way City, which was fought in Vietnam in 1968.
When you tell people about this, not necessarily in the book, it's really interesting. How do you describe that experience to people?
You know, ironically, the thing I tell them is if you've ever seen a movie like Full Metal Jacket, it was pretty much exactly like that movie.
Wow.
Which is very surreal mm-hmm. in that, there are surreal cycles, and I write a little bit about this in the book, cycles of violence and culture that exist. So I remember being in Fallujah, and we had been in Iraq for about 4 months at that point. And when you're Marines in Iraq, even in the war zone, there's uniform standards, there's things you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't write graffiti on your helmet. If you have your machine gun ammunition that's belted, you put it in the pouch. I remember about 3 days into that battle, which was very intense and still the most intense fighting I was ever involved in, I looked at the Marines in my platoon and, you know, suddenly one of the machine gunners had like a ace of spades and royal flush in his helmet band, and they were all wearing the ammunition, their bandolier sort of poncho Villa style across mm-hmm. their bodies, and they were kind of acting out these roles they had seen in movies, but they were the real thing. And if someday the movie had been made about them, it would be kind of a feedback loop of the original movie. But to your point, when people have asked me about it, I've said that's actually the closest I can describe succinctly to you of sort of what that particular experience was like.
And what was your role?
I was a platoon commander.
Which means
so
what?
There are about 40 Marines in a platoon, and so I was the lieutenant in charge.
In a situation like that, what does that mean?
You know, it means you're responsible for everything that your platoon does or fails to do, and you're the most junior officer, sitting in command of those Marines.
Did you feel that your training had prepared you for this moment? Was there something that you drew on?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, by the time I was sitting there, I went into the Marines. I mean, I made the commitment to go into the Marines when I was 17. I then went to college and did the ROTC. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I was 24, I had been on this path for 6 years at that point. Had spent a year training in Quantico, and it had all sort of built to that. So you felt prepared in that sense, but you didn't feel prepared so you knew what was going to happen. And the amount of chaos that existed in that battle, couldn't be overstated.
The end of the book is so interesting. It's called A Summary of Action. And you have the official recounting of what happened. And then you have sort of what really had sort of like the annotated version of it, what you sure. really were thinking, what you were feeling. And I want to read one of them and then ask you a little bit about it. This is what is said about you. During the day, Lieutenant Ackerman recommended to his company commander that if he pushed south approximately 150 meters, he would essentially be in an ambush position as the sun rose the following day. Under the cover of darkness on the early morning of 14 November, his platoon quietly moved 150 meters forward of a company position and set up a strong point with good field of fire. And then we have your response or what you think of what was going on in your head. We snuck forward on the lines around 2 a.m., the idea being that we'd set up like we did at the candy store. When I explained it to the platoon, nobody said anything. The last time we did this, we round up we wound up surrounded. I'm really interested in your choice to let us into this, let the reader in to what was really going on, what was really happening, and why you think it's effective next to the official statements.
Yeah, interestingly enough, that chapter wasn't in the book when I first submitted it, sold it, and my publisher was going to publish the book. We're delighted. We love the book, Elliot. We're excited to put it out. And my editor, Scott Moyers, a great editor, mm-hmm. Sat me down quickly and said, Elliot, again, we like the book, but I think, you're leaving something out. And, we know on your bio that you got this award and you don't really tell us specifically mm-hmm. what happened to you. And that's fine if you don't want to do that. But I just want you to know, you are leaving something out and we noticed that. So just think about it. And so I did. I thought about it and he was right. And I was, but I didn't know how to necessarily write about the things that really specifically happened to me. As I was thinking about it, I had this document. And what a summary of action is there's, when awards are presented, there's a citation, which is a short one page summation of what happened that's read mm-hmm. out loud. But then to give someone an award, I've written up many of these types of awards for my career, you write a very long summary of action saying, like, this is exactly what happened. It's done in a very formal language. And the summary of action is what the person is, based on the strength of the summary of action, that's when the award is actually given. So I had the summary of action for the award that I had gotten. And so thinking about how do I write about this, I'd read it a few times. I said, there's all this stuff I've always wanted to like fill in the summary of action, like the little details that nobody knows about, what it was like. Yes, in the section you read, when I went to our platoon, and we had lost about half of our number. We were mm-hmm. almost combat ineffective. And when I came back to them, 2 days later, I said, okay, guys, listen, we're going to go do basically exactly what we did 2 days ago, where we got really messed up, and we're going to go do it again. And how right. everybody looked back at you and said, okay, I guess we're going to go do it again. Those are the types of little details that never make it into official government documents. And so in this chapter, I feel like that summary of action gave me a way to get into the experience.
What do you hope people take away from those, from your accounts, from those accounts?
The humanity. You look at, people, yes, I've seen Marines do so many brave things. I've seen people who aren't Marines do brave things, and at the end of the day, they're just people. They're just regular people in extraordinary circumstances who are just trying to do what needs to get done. You asked me what it was like, and I gave you the combat, and I said, it's like Full Metal Jacket. The other thing I tell people, it's like a car crash. It's like if you're driving down the highway and you were to see a really bad car crash happen, and you see someone trapped in the car, you probably stop and just do whatever you could do to help. And that's sort of what being in a bad firefight's like. It's like a car crash, and everyone is just scrambling around trying to do what they can do to get out of the situation.
That's interesting, as you describe it that way, because the book, there's so much, hence the title, there's so much reflection in the book that what you're describing to me is that those in the moment, immediate impulses, and that now, years later, time later, you can actually have a time to reflect on what those impulses meant.
Yeah, I remember several times, in Iraq or Afghanistan, and on tough days, looking at guys and saying to them, like, just don't think about it right now. Just don't think about it. We're just going to get through this, and I promise you, you will have the rest of your life to sit there and pick apart everything that happened today.
My guest is Elliot Ackerman. The name of his book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. You write a bit in the book about missing war and how that might sound really odd to people. What does missing war mean to you?
Well, the title of the book, War, Revolution, and Returning, the returning is sort of a double entendre. It's not just returning home, it's also returning to the war. And working as a journalist, one of the things that I don't know if it was surprising. It was at first surprising and very predictable. Was you would see lots of other journalists, photographers, whomever, and the common thread was that all of us had served in Iraq and Afghanistan a decade before. Those of us who are now covering Syria. So I think that to me is kind of central to what the war has meant.
But it's also that idea you write about having a goal and the sense of purpose, right?
Right, and I think that. People will talk a lot about like PTSD, for instance, and what it is, because I feel like it's become a real blanket topic. And, you know, there's certainly like the type of PTSD where people have, you know, flashback night mm-hmm. terrors. And I'm not saying any of this to diminish that, because that's a very real thing. But there's also this like much larger and more insidious form of PTSD, which is sort of, I would say, purposelessness. And what I mean by that is, I think when you go to war at a young age, you develop kind of a dysfunctional relationship with purpose. So I think we could all agree that to be happy in life, one has to have a sense of purpose. To give you like a very banal example, like there's, you know, let's say there's a man, he works a job, the job puts food on the table for his family, he watches his children grow, they get a better education than him, they have a nicer life. That's the purpose that fills that person up. When you go to war at 19, 20, 21 years old, your sense of purpose is, let's say you're in Afghanistan, you have to secure a remote hilltop, or you're in Iraq, you have to secure a certain neighborhood. You have, at least at the tactical level, a mission that's very clear. Mm-hmm. And you have to achieve that mission with people who will likely become some of your very best friends. So your sense of purpose is again, it's hyper clear, it's crystalline. Like if purpose is the drug that induces happiness, you at 20, 21 years old start, you're freebasing the crystal meth of purpose.
Like there condensed.
There is nothing more intense than this purpose that you're doing.
Yeah.
You do it for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, however many years you do it, and eventually the war ends. You come home and you have to repurpose yourself. Find your next purpose, and maybe you look around, and maybe it's, you know, you're gonna go get a job at Home Depot, or you're gonna go back to college, or whatever it is, but it's not that crystal meth of purpose. If anything, it's kind of like the Coors Light of purpose. And you realize that the rest of your life, you're gonna spend sitting on your front porch, drinking Coors Light, and a certain depression sets in.
You can read about that. You can read about so much more in the book, Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. Such an interesting book. Elliot Ackerman, thank you so much for joining us. It's nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
This is All of It on WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.